podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson with Mike Bancoli. I've got Sean Rogers and I've got Dan Morgan. We're going to be looking ahead to the game that is coming up on Monday night. It feels so far away. There's so much life to live before we reach that point. But on Monday night, Liverpool do go not to Filbert Street, but to the King Power. I nearly said Filbert Street, to face Leicester City. That is coming up on Monday evening. The manager did a press conference early today. We're going to talk about that a little bit in part one and jump off from there. We've got the Leicester build-up to come in part four. In part two, we've got me talking to Dan Morgan, who is here as well, about James's place, the work that goes on there. And John Gibbons is speaking to the editor of Red All Over the Land, John Pearman. That is to come in part three as well. All of that is there for us. The press conference today was, coming to you first on it, Mike, really. It was a bit of a slightly contemplative, a little bit lackluster affair. Genuinely felt by the end of it, he almost just seemed like he'd not had enough of Liverpool, but had enough of sitting in front of the journalists to cover Liverpool. It's been a long season, and it's been a season full of change and transition. We'll come on to that, Mike, first and foremost, but it was a long season last season as well. It was a short break. It's been a long season, this one, albeit with the World Cup break in the middle. It just sort of, he really came over today, the manager, like he's been doing this job and this bit of this job for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think he felt quite weary in the press conference. He wasn't his usual kind of like flamboyant stuff. Even the way at times he was sat quite like in his chair, laid back. He was quite like just not in he was in one of his like, I just want to get stuck into coaching kind of moods, where he just wants to get these three games out of the way and end this season. And look, it has been a long season. I think we as fans forget that the turnaround between last season, which was a season where we played every single game possible, and the current season was very, very short. Your preseason starts so shortly after we lose the Champions League final, and you're back running that race again. So I think I can understand when the manager, his demeanor, he felt a bit tired in the press conference. But I do think that he's looking forward to attacking these last three games.
There's something I think, sure. Mike, the other thing to sort of point out, what sort of hit me was, he actually said at one point, we're about to go into the analysis meeting. And I think that within there, he suddenly said, we're about to go into the analysis meeting. And all of a sudden, I thought, God, you're leaving that late. And I went, oh, no, the game's Monday. I sort of wonder if in his head, you know, he's almost still away from this game. There's other things still to do, you know, so he hasn't even sat down and done the full analysis on Leicester yet. All that's still to come. So it is a bit of a funny press conference for him. Often he's doing them on Friday, the game Saturday. You know, that's where you're beginning to ramp up. I felt he was almost a little bit the opposite of ramped up. And as I say, by the end, when they were trying to draw him again on the top four race, he just seemed a little bit like, well, what are we all sitting here and doing, boys?
Absolutely. And I think for the manager, he is someone that wears his heart on his sleeve, and you can often tell how he feels by how he looks. He's not someone that's like playing mind games or concealing anything from the press. And I do think that he's in the zone where he just wants to, you know, he's probably thinking about the meeting he has after his press conference. And then beyond that, just focusing on the Leicester game. I don't think he actually gives a damn about the press conference today. There are times he wants to entertain the journalist and have a good time with him and have a chat and have a joke, and he's a bit more flamboyant. But today it was very much like, I've got to do this again, really? Okay, I'll talk to you, James Pearce. I'll talk to you, Neil Jones, for a bit. You know, we'll have a chat. But he's really focused on that meeting after the press conference and preparing for Leicester. I think that's all the manager cares about at the moment.
One interesting thing he draws out, Sean, is the idea of, you know, he is quite contemplative about the season. He goes out of his way on three or four occasions to criticise the season to an extent. You know, and towards the end, he's saying, you know, we all think we've been pretty rubbish, but we're sitting here with 62 points in a really direct way. But I think there's definitely something in him, in firstly him, I think. And I wonder whether or not, as we draw closer and closer to the season, he's more in reflective mode over what's happened and what's gone wrong, because he doesn't have to now live the reality of it week by week. He doesn't have to now try and fix it. He's not that far away from there being a genuine 38-game/all-the-cup-game review moment of being able to look at it. And I do wonder whether or not that's been a little bit in his mindset as they've gone away to Barcelona. You'd think he'd be remiss if him and his coaching team weren't having those sorts of conversations at this point. And he makes a couple of interesting noises around when it goes wrong, when do you change, when do things need to be different. I'm always reminded of the point earlier in the season, much earlier in the season before the World Cup, where he talked about freshening it tactically, going all the way back to, for instance, when he moved it to 4-4-2 around the time of that Arsenal away game when they're absolutely dreadful. I do think that they will be thinking themselves about what is the right or wrong thing to do, not least because this is uncharted territory for most managers, but even for a manager like Jurgen Klopp, moving from year 7 and imagining all the way through to year 10.
Yes, I think in terms of their actual real key turning point, I guess it's obviously the conversations and discussions that he alludes to with the players as well. Obviously doesn't go into detail in terms of the inner discussions with the coaching team, that which is a really sensible one and a good thing that they did, to say, look, they must have had a feeling that morale was down, that people couldn't wait for the season to end. And I think Liverpool just made the decision that next season starts now, but it literally really does. And by making changes to the system, it's not just what that means for the players on the pitch. I think it's very important psychologically for them that the senior players, the key senior players, that system really fits. It's more important that it works for Liverpool by getting results, by the way. But if a byproduct of that is that the likes of Van Dijk, Mo Salah, Trent feel better within that system, then you've gone a long way to boost the morale in that squad. And if you get the best out of them three players, you're also more likely to get results for Liverpool. It also means the training sessions freshen up, the team meetings freshen up, like everything freshens up. It's not just a football skill, it's a skill in life, I guess, that all of us are hypocrites, where if you were to look at yourselves objectively, as if you were like consulting to yourself, well, certainly in my case, there'd be a hell of a long list about changes and improvements that you should and could be making. So one skill is being objective enough to actually do that. The bigger challenge is then executing on that yourself. And it's one of them things with managers that have been at a club for a long time. You sometimes feel like sometimes they have to leave the club just through basically everyone's burnt out. And a new manager could come in and do virtually the same things, or what the old manager was going to do to change things. And it's just that bit of freshness. And obviously you can see things like Sir Alex Ferguson, who, you know, obviously was very good at freshening things up in terms of training, in terms of his number two, at freshening squads up. And that's a big, big challenge for anyone. And then you've got this tricky element of, if you think things might go wrong or that the game's changed and you need to do something, it's very difficult, I think, for a manager, especially one like Klopp that's had success, to do that ahead of time. And it's not nice to live through, but I think you have to let it fall off a cliff. And to be able to carry people with you is vital. And he needs people to be looking at him going, okay, we now need you. What are you going to... You almost need internally people to be questioning him. And then he needs to bring the right bunny out of the hat at that point. And that's when he does need to nail it. So if he'd have made these system changes and the results had been worse and the senior players were like, this is making my life harder, then we'd have had a major problem, I think.
Just on that, Sean, just on that idea of the system change, you know, I'm quite... There's bits and pieces of it now, for instance, that you're seeing as it continues, where it's actually not that far away from some of what we were trying at the very start of the season. You know, it's not a million miles away. I remember sort of feeling a bit like at times we've got this... I think it's changed a little bit around Robertson almost more than anything else. Because I remember sort of thinking to myself, are we determined to have the fullbacks assist one another every game at this point? You know, it was quite mad. And I think that, you know, I feel as though Trent is now much more pronounced than he was. But apart from that, there are a fair few similarities in patches of games to the start of the season, when, as you say, the results were a bit of a nightmare and maybe the players weren't entirely bought in.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of quick things on that you can reference. One is that instead of Liverpool building in a two, because of the fact they're building with a three, it means Liverpool are more robust in transition, which ultimately then means that Virgil van Dijk in particular is having a better time of things and not being made to look a divvy. And more importantly for Trent, there's not oceans of space in the fullback areas because Liverpool have got three back there rather than two when they lose the ball. So it doesn't make Trent look a divvy. And if you're Fabinho, having someone in alongside him, which at this point is Trent when they're building the play, also makes him look better. I think, you know, one example I always use where it went well is Jose Mourinho, when Porto had won the Portuguese treble and he just felt things were going stale and he decided to move to a diamond. He thought that it could work, but he thought he really needed to freshen up. Now, they actually go on to have a really successful season, and everyone's comments after that were that was a really big thing to do. Contrast that with Antonio Conte in his season at Chelsea. He wants to make the changes, but he does the right thing. He goes, this isn't going to work, but I need to give them enough rope for this to go wrong. So I agree with you, Neil, that it's not massively far removed from what we were doing. But I think it's got, and I don't think they've done this deliberately. I don't think Klopp's gone, I know this is going to go wrong, but I've got to let it go and ruin a season. That's not the point at all. I think it works well when the team have to look for you for a solution. The pressure's then on to nail it, whatever you do. And I think when things go well, then changes can even be over-exaggerated a little bit because everyone's just feeling a hell of a lot better about themselves and it's working.
Other sort of bits of the way in which he's speaking around all of that, Dan, I feel as though, as he sort of wears through today, there's sort of a minute in work, really basic Anfield app example, I'm thinking about what we're going to do for shows over the summer. And I've got a load of ideas for all the subscriber shows, really cool stuff we can do, so on and so forth. I've got ideas and we'll take them forward.
That new lost tape's good.
And they will be a bit of pressure on them in the summer months, Dan.
Yeah, the odd guest has been terrible on there. Dan's been amazing. But
there is, with it, Dan, as I'm thinking about that, every now and again I'll have to deal with something that's now. And I'll almost be like, almost startled that there's now stuff to think about. We were having a bit of a chat about a couple of things we can do in the next couple of weeks. And I was almost like, Jesus, yeah, they're good ideas. Someone should have been thinking of them. Whereas I'm very much in the summer. And, you know, I wonder, for instance, the stuff with the new, what looks like he will be the new sporting director, Jörg Schmadtke, I wonder the extent to which when they have gone away here, we've sort of thought, oh, he'll be getting them all conditioned for the last three games of the season, so on and so forth. I just sort of wonder whether or not they've had a bit of a getaway. It's in as much about the plotting of the next thing. And that's why the manager today is almost a bit like, yeah, we've got to do these three. And I'm sure they're absolutely desperate to win them and bounce in and see if they can put pressure on for the Champions League spots. But his brain might also still be a little bit in summer, in recruitment, in sporting directors, in all this sort of stuff. And it's going to be after today's analysis meeting around Leicester, his brain's going to be all Leicester.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I think what is noticeable about today is he's not banging the drum of counter-pressing and gegenpressing, which he's done on about the past four or five press conferences. And that's clearly...
Very much has, yes.
Clearly, pointed and message sending that. And that's clearly been in line with this change of shape that Liverpool have implemented with Alexander-Arnold. And I think he's been really trying to get that message across through the press. And he is clever like that. He does come across quite cantankerous on press conferences and he does come across as quite irked. And he will forever intrigue me as a man and a manager of Liverpool Football Club in his behaviour to certain things. But, I think he does use them in certain ways to push out the message that he needs, and that's definitely been one. And I think the reason he's not mentioning that now is because I think he probably feels like we've nailed it. And that's not to say that, you can sort of get complacent about the last three games. I think the Leeds represent their own challenge. But, I think you can see that Liverpool are in rhythm, probably for the first time this season. And
he's just had a week working with them, Dan. So yeah, he might be what we've seen there in the training. He's like, no, whether we see it properly done in games, he's seeing them in training and thinking, no, they're getting this. This is where I want them to be.
I think the training ground's fizzing. Like, I think it is. And I think that, I think you can tell that just from the way that the players are interacting with the social media accounts a bit more within training and just those little snippets that you see. That, obviously we guess at because we're not privy to, but I think there's a good suggestion there that the confidence is high between them and that they sort of really relish in getting out there now. And I think, one of the things he has talked about, hasn't he, is having time to coach. And I think Juliet Ferrington tried to elaborate on that today, that idea of, him being a coach rather than a manager. And yeah, it's something he's referenced before. And the ideas of him being able to work on things like set pieces, the ideas of him being able to work on this new shape, and actually do that rather than just building recovery and analysis, then it's obviously going to be impactful, and I think it's going to play a part for pre-season as well. We don't know what the details of pre-season are just yet fully, but you'd imagine that he's going to be advocating for as much time as he can possibly have with them to get heads down, get miles in the legs, and also just drill in what we're going to look like shape-wise, because never feels like the next evolution is that far away in this league. And, it might be that we're all sat here in 9 months' time saying about, remember the time we all used to play a fullback in midfield areas. That was a while ago, wasn't it? Because we've all moved on to the next thing. And then you just don't know what that will be. But we need to be ahead of that curve now. We fell behind. And, hopefully that's something that building competence around the manager will lead to. And that includes this new potential sporting director.
Sporting director stuff's interesting, Mike. I think one of the issues with it is, it's firstly, it's a job that you don't get to see anyway. Secondly, it's a job that everyone Every club probably applies a little bit differently. Everyone's sort of working it out. I doubt every job spec's exactly the same. And then there's a third part of this, which is that you get the impression individual sporting directors can decide to take the job a little bit in the direction that they want to take it in. The Schmeichel thing, where people have got some stated reservations, is obviously the nature of the clubs he's worked at before, and also the idea he may well have been looking at a bit of retirement. But I'm sort of reminded on the bit of retirement about the same way the manager, for instance, was taking some time out the game. And then we got him in October when everyone thought he was likely to be on a year off or something like that. I'm less concerned about that. You know, for me, the key question is whether or not the manager's getting the support he needs through there. And also whether or not there's enough robust challenge within Liverpool. And at least the personality type, as has been discussed, is at least framed as a fiery one. And I actually don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing, actually. I think one of the ways in which we know the Michael Edwards and Klopp relationship works was that there was, you know, polite challenges between the two of them, where I remember our very first summer when we wanted to rebuild the team and we wanted to sign, you know, a forward, a midfielder and a centre-back, I think it was. And Jurgen Klopp wanted Gertz to be his attacker. And I think there was a back and forth, and Mane was actually recommended to him, or we missed out on Gertz, and Mane was the backup choice. And I remember Julian Brandt as well was a target around that same summer. So I think it is good for the manager to have his ideas in terms of a player we should try and identify challenged, because it's worked in the past for us where the manager's maybe wanted a player and we've actually ended up going for a player that's been recommended for him. Another one is Mo Salah,
yep,
who's recommended for him, and the manager ended up obviously taking him on, and the rest is history. So I think that's what we want to get back to, where there are these conversations happening, these dynamic conversations in the cafeteria, as they mentioned. I've already spoken about this in the book, about how, you know, there are these conversations that happen in the cafeterias where people have been challenged, people expressing their views, because that's worked for us well in the past. And I think the fact that this guy is a big character, charismatic, and someone who's not afraid to challenge the manager means that, you know, we trust that the decisions they come to at the end of the day will be following robust conversations where there are loads of things being considered, everyone's thoughts being considered, and then we come to the right conclusion for the club at the end of the day.
There's something, I think, Sean, in this idea that right now you've got to be careful not to get sort of too carried away with a notion, but I think there is something in the idea of the future planning being the overriding factor, and the games are just a byproduct of that. And whilst, you know, I've said all the way through they're gonna, you know, it's a big nine and they're gonna win all nine, and then, you know, you'll wait and see, I think it's legitimate that he wants to play that down as much as possible, because I think he does, as you say, he does sort of see this very much as the start of next season, and he does still see this as development. If there is Champions League qualification, both in terms of the transfer market, from what he said today, and in terms of this, the reality of just getting to play Champions League football, I think he's just going to see it as a bonus. I think that's almost where he is now, and maybe even one that afterwards he says, well, we don't deserve this, because he couldn't be more clear about how poor he thinks the side's been at times. And, you know, I think it's a striking mindset. He's very much not unleashing the hounds of war today and saying, we're hunting these people down. If anything, he's doing quite the opposite. He's saying it is difficult for the sides that we are chasing, but the good sides, and we've got our thing to worry about. It's hard to win six on the bounce. It's harder to win seven. It'll be harder if they manage to do it to win eight. To me, that's where he feels like his mindset is. It very much isn't in the idea of fourth place. It's in the idea of, well, the best possible place next season.
Yeah, and I think Dan was absolutely spot on when he was talking about the press conferences, and quite often Klopp seems to have a message there that's more for the players and potentially employees of Liverpool than actually, you know, the fans or anyone in the room at the time. He can't be in there, and I genuinely think he believes it, saying, look, the season starts now, forget everything that's been and gone this season, we're going on this direction of travel from a mentality point of view, from a pressing point of view, we're going to do this with the system, this is what we're going to do, and if it goes well, we know what we're doing in pre-season. And I think at this point in time, he'd have a massive challenge, wouldn't he, if he comes back to pre-season and sits Trent, Van Dijk and Salah down and go, you know that thing we were doing where we won the last nine, whether we get in the Champions League or not, I'm not doing that anymore. Now, even if he thinks that they do need to change it, how you go about doing that probably has to be a hell of a lot more subtle, and it needs to be eased in when you've gone through something like this. And also for the recruitment side of this, they need to have an idea, not just internally, but also players are going to go. This, if they're any good and they're well represented, which you'd imagine they would, like, well, where do I fit into this new system? Or I quite like that Curtis Jones role, or I quite like the look of that Fabinho role, or I'd quite like sitting in there with Trent. What happens when Trent's not in there? these are things they need to decide upon, because it has a massive impact on the recruitment structure anyway. And yeah, I think in terms of the Champions League, you can be out of it for 1 year. I don't think it's necessarily the end of the world for Liverpool. I think Liverpool could ride it financially. It's not ideal, but they could. And for the manager, you can't let one become two. And that means Liverpool have to hit the ground running. And to hit the ground running, they could really do with ideally your way of playing being nailed before pre-season and then early signings so you can integrate them in. And yeah, I agree with everything that's been said, you know, in terms of the sporting director role. I think two things I would say. Every sporting director role is different. And I mean, even within the same club, yeah. You know, Liverpool might have different things that they want a sporting director to do right now than what has been before. An easy example, Michael Edwards needed to do Kirby. That's probably what burnt him out. Well, the sporting director coming in doesn't need to do that. It might be that they want the new sporting director to do more with the press and more in communications. It might be that there's more to do with agents. You might have a sporting director coming in that's more to do with contracts, so that Mike Gordon has less on. I think people underestimate massively how good and important Dave Fallows and Barry Hunter are. And I think they underestimate the quality of data analysis and records that are within Liverpool now. Now, a lot of good people have left Liverpool and a lot of good people are leaving Liverpool. So in years to come, they've got to try and maintain that. But those records are still there. Like, Liverpool know probably more about any player than most football clubs. So, you know, a sporting director's not coming in here having to completely start from scratch, yeah. Whoever it is. And yeah, I think the most, you know, I don't think it's any secret that Jurgen Klopp needs someone to come in that ultimately is willing to throw hooks at him. And it's a very, you know, really like loads of friction, but in a healthy way. And I think that's what's being alluded to ultimately. It's got to be a bit of a, almost like an Alex Ferguson dressing room. It's got to be on the edge without ever going past the boiling point.
Excellent stuff indeed from Mike, from Dan, and from Sean. Coming up in a second is Dan Morgan talking about James's place with me. It's recorded earlier today. Also, John Gibbons then talking to John Pearman from Red all over the land. But here's me and Dan, and we'll be back in a second to build up Leicester.
It is a lot of Dan Morgan. It's Dan Morgan and his other guys. The work that he does for James's place is what he's here to talk about, as it is Mental Health Awareness Week next week. And Dan, you know, James's place is, as I know, looking to expand at the minute. I know you're talking in other places all the time. But James's place is first and foremost as a core Liverpool element to it.
Yeah, I think it's something that we are very, very proud of, that, you know, the inception of James's place was in Liverpool, and that was in 2018. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, we got a lot of help from Liverpool City Council, who really helped us and championed us and gave us an opportunity in the city. And I think if we know one thing about Liverpool, it's a very proud place, and it's a place that loves to you know, claim the birthright to something, and it can very much do that with James's place, because you know we did open the service in London, and that was as James's place was, you know, very early on and coming out of a pandemic, but that brought with it its own challenges. And I think, you know, without having the experience of Liverpool, the men we'd helped in Liverpool, we wouldn't have been able to do that. And like you said, with the expansion, you know, we wouldn't now be looking to open another centre by the end of this year and another three in the next 3 to 5 years, which is, you know, it's just amazing considering, you know, where we've come from.
The centre that you're looking to open this year, where is it?
It's in Newcastle. And, you know, that is informed geographically. We want to be a service which is able to be accessible for men across the country within around 2 hours. You know, so if a man is in a suicidal crisis, he can get to a James Place Centre from north to south within 2 hours. You know, so we looked at that, and then also we looked at statistics by region. What are the key sort of elements driving people to a suicidal crisis? What are the obvious optics around men in a suicidal crisis, and where is that increasing? And obviously there's a need, we feel, for the James's Place Centre in the northeast. And just like Liverpool, you know, the professional services, the general community have been really receptive, really helpful, really on board, as you can imagine. So, you know, we're in that process now, and we're hoping to open the centre there before the end of this calendar year, which would be, again, it'd be amazing progress for us.
The centres, it's important to sort of describe them. I recently went for the first time to the one in Liverpool prior to doing a little bit of work with Jane Boland this week on a fundraising quiz in Duke Street Markets. And the centres themselves, it's not a cold clinical setting. Instead, you know, they're very environmentally warm, very much created to sort of allow people to be at their ease in there as well. You know, so when you're thinking about a centre, you're not just thinking about getting a room. You know, it is an investment, because you're looking to create the circumstances that help. You know, the therapeutic support is supported by the nature of the location wherein you end up being, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think it's so important, because a lot of the time it'll be a man's first experience with any organisation in this demographic. You know, it'll be a place where, you know, someone might have misconceptions around what they might be walking into, and it might be something that they're really unsure about. But as you've mentioned, one of the main pieces of feedback we get all the time is about the centres, and it's about the fact that, you know, people are greeted at the door by name, you know, they're offered a cup of tea, they're really nurtured, they're really cared for, and we try and create an environment where it's that person's space for the hour or however long that they're there. And that, you know, that informs the work in many ways, because, you know, we do insist on being a centre-based service. That's why we are trying to open three more centres, is because we don't run an online service. We are a service which, you know, has to act immediately. It's a crisis resolution service. It works with somebody to essentially save their life in a very sort of strictly immediate and quick sense. And we have to then put in the other factors around that, which can help a person who might be in that crisis. And one of the constant pieces of feedback we get is, like I said, just how warm the centre is, you know, how homely in many senses it is. And, you know, we are, you know, in Liverpool, we are in a wonderful building in the Georgian Quarter. And it is, you know, it's got incredible light, and it's got incredible warmth, it's got incredible space. And it's amazing for me, because obviously I'm in the London centre, and it's amazing how much we replicated both centres down to such finite details as the artwork on the walls, and, you know, the furniture and the lighting, and that really, really warms me, and it gives me great hope for the future centres of James Place to come, that we are replicating this entire intervention that we're delivering to people across the country.
It's a bold ambition to be within, you know, by the end of 2026, to be that half the male population of England will be within 2 hours of a centre. It opens up the idea of treating up to approximately 2,000 men a year. I mean, in a way that also shows the depth with which people's mental health does need to be approached, and the care that, you know, is sadly lacking in a number of different areas around that, and the stresses and strains that are on everybody within there. But it is an ambitious move, isn't it? You know, 2,000 men a year would be an enormous number.
It would, but like you say, that there is a gap in provision, we feel, for a service like ours, you know, and that is why, you know, that is why we are first and foremost a service which operates to work with men only. So, you know, we get asked that question a lot, why we only work with men. Well, the statistics speak for themselves around male suicide and male suicidal crisis. But also, you know, we want to be the best at what we do. And if that means we are slightly more niche than others, then we're happy with that, because, you know, we have to by our sheer existence ensure that we are a service that can treat someone immediately. It's no good coming to James's Place for help if you're in a suicidal crisis and us saying, well, we have a waiting list of X amount of weeks or months. That defies its sheer existence. So we need to be a service which is free, which is immediate, which gets to the core of somebody's crisis straight away, and also works with them, you know, if we're not the service that might be the best for them in this particular moment. And that does happen. You know, we don't end up, you know, working with everybody who comes to us, and there's a number of factors why. But we do, like you said, we help a lot of men, and we help a lot of men all of the time get to the bottom of what's going on with them really quickly. And to do that, you know, again, we have to have certain things in place operationally, and that, you know, that's something that we do look after and we have a plan for. It's great that, you know, for instance, all of our therapists are employed by us and are all trained in our model, and that will continue across the country. And that, you know, not only gives the man who might be coming to work with us that sense of safety, of familiarity, of routine built into his life, but also, you know, it allows us to, again, you know, take the work that we've already done, which is academically evaluated and it's proven to be working, and take that, you know, further across the board. And it's all positive in that sense. And, you know, we're learning all the time about, you know, this sort of field of work. But one of the things that remains fundamental to us is that we are quick and we're accessible and we're there straight away for somebody who might be in that place.
There is a 24/7 crisis line. If you text SHOUT, the word SHOUT, to 85258, that gets through to James's place. Obviously, within all of this, there are other services as well. On the James's Place's website, they mention the Samaritans 116 123 is the phone number there. The centres are currently in Liverpool and London, as Dan says. The James's Place's website is jamesplace.org.uk. That's the word James, the word place.org.uk. Thank you very much to Dan. We will get over now onto our next segment, and then Dan himself will be back talking about Liverpool versus Leicester, or the other way around.
And it is John Gibbons from Tour Live. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by John Pearman, who's the editor of Red All Over the Land. John, thanks so much for coming in, first of all. It's a pleasure to see you and welcome you here.
Thank you for having me in. It's a lovely building. I've been really surprised. It's a lovely day outside as well, and everybody's in the Eurovision mood.
Yeah, it's lively in Liverpool city centre at the moment, that is for sure. We're here to talk a little bit about an event you've got going on in early June. But before we do that, lots of people listening will know Red All Over the Land. It's been going a long time. You were telling me before, since 1985. But people who maybe haven't been to Anfield before, or maybe even only been sort of once or twice, might not know about the fanzine and its crucial part in Liverpool supporting culture. So first of all, educate people in your own words all about Red All Over the Land, if you don't mind.
Well, I started the fanzine back in 1995. I was looking for a way out of the job that I was doing, and I just wanted to do something that was going to occupy my time. I was looking for early retirement, although I was only just 51 years of age at the time. So the idea of doing a fanzine was put to me by a fellow Red, who was associated with other fanzines at the time. And I said, well, I'm going to give it a go. And somebody says, what will you call it? And straight off the top of my head came Red All Over the Land, because I said, we've got supporters coming from all over the country, so they'll be reading it, so hence Red All Over the Land. And people said it sounded all right. It stuck. We started off, like many others, basically using sellotape, prick stick, anything they could do, felt tip pens and Tippex and that, but it got going eventually, and we came out on November the 18th, 1995. We were playing Everton at Anfield. It rained. We lost 2-1, but we sold about 400 copies. So I thought, yeah, it's got time. And the important thing to note since that day is, on that day, Everton were the FA Cup holders, Liverpool were the League Cup holders. Since that day, Everton haven't won a trophy, and I think Liverpool have won a few, but I can't quite remember how many. So if I did curse Everton on the way home, I'll just say it worked.
And not a bad lucky charm for Liverpool. And over the years, you must have had sort of so many writers and people who often start out with fanzines, don't they? And I know a lot of people who I'm friends with who wanted to write about football and didn't really know how or where to start. And it was, you know, your local fanzine editor like yourself who gave a lot of people a go.
Yeah, we gave quite a few people who are now, should we say, celebrities. I'm not going to name names. It's unfair because I might miss somebody out. But yeah, we gave people the opportunity to write for us. We've had countless people write, literally hundreds over the 27.5 years existence of the fanzine. As I say, some of them were went on to be professional writers, have written books. Others drifted back into oblivion. Their work will be treasured by the British Library, where their grandchildren, great-grandchildren go and read it in years to come. But yeah, people did come along, people who had no idea of how to write or what to write about. And I just said, well, I'm no expert, so just go ahead and write whatever you wish. And people did. We had people sending in poems. We had people sending in attempts for songs. Nothing for the Eurovision, unfortunately. But yeah, so we got people coming along, writing, wanting to write, and a few people who could do sketches. We had some good people in that line. Again, the guy who we've got at the moment has been with us over 10 years. But we had others that came along and, again, say they went their own way. So we also did a lot of things which seemed to start around 1997 when Rick Parry got involved with the club. Rick's had his critics, but one thing he did, he opened the door to fan groups such as fanzines. And we were one of the fanzines that took him up on his invite to go along. And he worked with us on a fair few projects. And not a lot of people know that the mosaics that are at Anfield now, done by Andy Knott. Andy is part of Red All Over the Land.
Yep.
And it was Red All Over the Land and Andy that suggested to Rick that we start doing them. And we did the first one, which made the papers, actually, because it was basically the whole cop with a red card, and we're playing Sheffield Wednesday. And they said that we were sending a message to the Sheffield Wednesday board, who at that time were basically refusing to accept any responsibility for Hillsborough. Things developed from there because we got in contact with the HJC, although we'd already worked with the Hillsborough Family Support Group. Mm-hmm. We got in touch with the HJC, and again, although we became a minor part player, we were one of those that instigated the boycott of Hillsborough in 1998, I think it was. So that had an impact. Rick also allowed us to invite people along to take penalties on the pitch. And what we did, we used that as an opportunity to raise money for charities. And over the lifetime of the fanzine, we've possibly raised nearly £30,000.
Wow.
For various things, which the HJC were people who we really worked hard with at the start. People like Sheila Coleman got involved with us. And of course, Jerry and Kenny, who were from the shop. So they were all working with us, and we raised good funds for them. And then we did money for Parkinson's, because at the time, of course, Ray Kennedy was suffering, and I'd had experience of it in my own family. So we raised a lot of money for that through these penalty shootouts on the pitch. We also were the instigators behind the homecoming of Gerard Houllier after his illness. And we, again, working with Rick and the club, Jed Poynton, the great, wonderful Brian Hall.
Mm-hmm.
We did the homecoming tribute. But possibly one of the nicest ones was we did an event to celebrate the times of Bob Paisley. And the following day, I got a phone call, and it was Bob's wife. And she said she was so moved by what had happened. And she asked me if she sent me £10, could she buy some fanzines? I declined the £10 and sent her some.
Oh,
so,
incredible.
Yeah, but we also did in 99, on the 40th anniversary of Shankly taking over, we did what we called Shankly Day. And it was brilliant on the cop. We actually got a lot of former Liverpool players from the 1965 Cup winning side and the 74 Cup winning side to come back. And we think it was quite unique because we managed to get Emlyn Hughes and Tommy Smith in the same changing room, or sorry, same room, and there was no arguments. But yeah, we got people like Kevin Keegan at the time was the England manager. He turned up. He couldn't join in for obvious reasons, but he came along and sat in the stand. He was part of it. And we had the 74 side on one side of the tunnel and the 65 side on the other side of the tunnel. And we had a piper playing Amazing Grace, which was quite brilliant, I felt. So when Rick left, so did a lot of our opportunities. And sadly, since then, despite our attempts, we've never actually met. We didn't meet with Christian Perslow, although he did offer several times, and then on the day of the meeting said he couldn't make it. On one occasion, I was on a train from Leicester to up here to meet him. Ian Eyre never met with us, although he did email a few times. And Peter Moores did finally get to know us, but never actually invited us to a meeting. So the club have not really involved themselves with us since 2008, 2009, which is sad. But we did a lot with the fans and the club. It wasn't one way. The club were very much part of it. Mm. But the thing is, Andy still does the mosaics, but they're no longer part of Red All Over the Land. It's now a club thing. But the fanzine's been going, as I say, 27 and a half years. We're closing in on 300 copies, which should be next February, weather permitting. And then maybe then I'll have to have a look how much longer I can continue doing what I do. Although if I didn't do the fanzine, I don't know what I would be doing. It'd possibly be garden and housework, and they're not on my top list.
No, absolutely
so
not.
That's the fanzine, and say we have three other people selling it apart from me. We have Steve Hales, who stands outside the COP. Andy Knott, who's at Flagpole Corner.
And has been for God knows how many years.
I met Andy outside Main Road in 1996, the week before the FA Cup final. And I'd used one of his flyers as a cover, and he come up and said, "That's my printing." I said, "Well, who are you?" he looked like Jesus because of his hair, and he still does. He told me who he was, and we became mates ever since. And we've been mates ever since.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, and there's other people like John Mackin, who I've known for nearly 30 years, Kevin Sampson, Dave Kirby, people like that, all good friends, Pete Carney, all good friends, and we don't knock around together or anything like that, but I'm proud to say that they are people who I know, and that's all through the fanzine. I've met some wonderful, wonderful people.
Brilliant. Fantastic. So on to the event itself then. Friday the 2nd of June at Hotel Anfield, which is 23 Anfield Road, there is an event with Phil Thompson. It's to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Shanks's third and final league title. And yeah, it should be a great event. I mean, Phil's a great talker, isn't he? He's a charismatic guy, people will know, but when you just think he's run out of stories, he's already got some more, and I'm sure he's really looking forward to this event and celebrating, you know, Shankly and this great team.
Well, of course, Phil was in his youth at that time. I think he was still a teenager when he first started getting in the side, and of course in 72, 73. I think he made about 14 or 15 appearances. So he was just breaking through. And of course, he was slightly different then with his long, curly hair, typical of the times. And he was part of Anfield's right up until he left the club to go into management for a brief period and then came back and went back into management with us as reserve team manager. And then, of course, with Gerard Houllier as first team coach, and whilst Gerard was ill, he took over this show. And I did actually meet Phil back in 2002, and he invited me to Melwood then and showed me round. So don't think he'll remember me, but yeah, he's a great guy, and he was one of the reasons I could actually sit down and watch soccer special on a Saturday afternoon on Sky. When he went, I thought, that's good. Don't have to watch it now. So I cancelled my subscription. Or we did. Yeah, but Phil's a great guy, and it's good to see he's still around the scene doing the things he does, and he still looks pretty fit.
Yeah, he looks fantastic, yeah. and sharp as anything. And as I says, he's got so many great stories. His Shankly impression's not bad either. I'm sure we'll sort of hear that on the night. And, you know, he just obviously, what I think, whenever I meet him, is his love for the club still beams through him. You know, you mentioned there him being a teenager probably at this point, you know, when he's breaking through. He was obviously so proud to play for Liverpool and still holds that pride. And listen, he's been let go a couple of times, he's been sacked a couple of times and things like that, but it doesn't seem to have, you know, there's no bitterness around him at all. He just absolutely loves the club, and that'll, I'm sure, come across for anyone who's lucky enough to get to the events.
Of course, one of the times when he left, there was a difference of the personality clashes, wasn't there? Yeah. So, and they happen. They happen in all walks of football, and not just at Liverpool. In fact, they're all walks of life.
Yeah.
But I agree, his love for the football club has never changed. And you only had to watch him on the Jeff Stelling show, and he was so passionate.
Yeah,
you felt at times he could got up and hit somebody if you said the wrong word. But you know, it's an old copite, and I can remember going back to the late 90s when he used to relate back to his days on the cop. And yeah, he was part of he's been part of the Liverpool fabric ever since he began playing for the club as a schoolboy. But he's just come out of schools. It was different then. There were no academies from the age of six. It was, you had to be spotted, and yeah, he got spotted, and yeah, the rest is history, as they say.
Absolutely. So the event itself, like I mentioned before, it's at Hotel Anfield on Anfield Road, 23 Anfield Road, Friday the 2nd of June. Doors open at 6, the show starts at 7. It's £25 a ticket, or you can get a table of 8 for £170, so save yourself a few bob there. Tickets available from www.redalloverthelandcom. That is www.redalloverthelandcom. And £25 includes you get fed, which is decent, and obviously the fantastic entertainment of the night, an evening with Phil Thompson to celebrate. And I'm sure you're really looking forward to it. I'm sure it'll be fantastic, and yeah, hopefully it goes really well. I'm sure it will.
Yeah, we've got David Jaggs on, who's from the Ragamuffins, who I'll call him the house band now at
yes, very much. Yeah,
David's a very, very passionate Liverpool fan. He tries to write the Liverpool songs, rearrange Liverpool songs. So he'll be there. We're hoping to have an auction and a raffle on the night to raise funds. And our ultimate is to build up money this year to something that I'm interested in. I've done it before in a different area for a different reason. Is dementia in football. It's a very, very tricky subject. The PFA, the Premier League, the FA, they seem to want to shove it under a table, sweep it under the carpet, do whatever they want, but not recognise it. And there's a lot of people out there from our own club who are now suffering from dementia. You can't. No one can turn around and say it's actually football related. But it's like you can't say a boxer's punch drunk because he got hit. Yeah, you know, the things go hand in hand. Mm. You're heading those footballs of 20, 30, 40 years ago. They had an effect. Mm. And it's a terrible, terrible illness to have to live with. And we want to, by the end of the year, we want to raise a few quid for that as well. And hopefully in November, we're going to be doing another event. And the headline act that day will be Kevin Keegan.
Brilliant. Fantastic. One to look forward to as well. But if you want tickets for this, as I say, redalloverthelandcom for an evening with Phil Thompson, Friday, 2nd of June. John, thanks so much for coming in. We'll have to get you in again when the Kevin Keegan thing's all finalised as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
And we are back to Build Up Leicester. Download the app for more and more Anfield app stuff if you do want to subscribe. Loads of fantastic stuff on the app. But building up Leicester, it is a massive game, Dan Morgan. It oddly only gets bigger if the results go our way. What struck me sort of working out a few different things across the course of the week is that I think it's possible that this is the first time. Maybe you'll disagree. Maybe you'll feel it was there in the previous two home games after Tottenham. But I wonder if this is the first time they'll feel as though there could be genuine pressure on them to get a result since they've changed the shape. with reference to the possibility of next season, especially if either Newcastle or Manchester United, who look like they may well be out without Marcus Rashford, drop points?
Perhaps. I do think they are. I do think that in some ways, you know, playing without pressure from confidence does remove a lot of context. You know, regardless if you're in a bit of a rhythm and you know that you've got lads around you you're in good form with and you trust in what you're doing as a team, then I think that can override something like a bit of scoreboard pressure or whether or not, you know, one of the other teams drop points at the weekend. Don't get me wrong, I think that will increase on Liverpool, but I think the thing that'll do for Liverpool is the context of the game itself. You know, Leicester have got to get something, essentially, so they're going to have a go at some point. The crowd are going to ensure that they get on the back if they're not doing so. And I just feel like I think the message from Liverpool will be, if we go a goal up in this game, these will be caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of what they do. And I think ultimately the weekend feels like it'll be defined by the first 45 minutes of each game.
Yeah,
I really do feel like that. I feel like, you know, if United are able to get a nose ahead against Wolves, I can't really see that changing. I think there's a lot of people who've got an eye on Leeds versus Newcastle, but Newcastle are flying for me still, and I think they'll come out going for it. I think they'll really have a goal for Leeds early on, and there's every chance that they could end up 2-0 up in 20. And I think the same for us. You know, I think we'll have a good goal at Leicester, and I think what's been really interesting. Obviously, you know, we chat a lot about the shape of Liverpool and stuff. I think what you're seeing now is, and I think it's the thing that'll buoy the manager the most, is that there really is tactically no answer to what we're doing, because we've managed to revert to keeping the ball and a lot of possession down our left side with this new shape. And you think if you look at sort of pass maps and the way we're keeping the ball, we're getting real overloads. We're getting four or five players down the left-hand side of that pitch now. We talked about moving Trent inverted, but he's still lining up and he's still reverting to right back when there's turnovers. But he's able to get back in because the ball's literally the other side of the pitch. So the thing we talked about all season, Trent in that area, is, you know, him being him being exploited, him, you know, not being maybe as confident as he should be 1v1, space being left. But how do you attack that side of the pitch when the ball is predominantly over the other side in the other corner? And I think that's just a microcosm of Liverpool giving teams a lot to work out against them this season. And I think Villa will be its own test for us. But I think on Monday we'll just have too much for Leicester in that sense.
Things will become their own test as it wears on, Mike. You know, and I think Villa, again, if one thing does go our way, and I agree with Dan's assessment of those other two games along with ours, that first halves in all of them, I think will be really rather significant. I think the idea then of having a greater sense as to where it is around the Villa game will matter. The thing about Monday night, though, is it is a Monday night. Leicester know they need literally just simply have the clarity of task, supporters and players alike, that they need to win one of the remaining three games, and they've got two of them at home, and Monday night is one of them. You know, the crowd could be a factor too. The only thing is that, you know, for instance, the manager mentioned the Everton game in his press conference, and Everton started that absolutely all over Leicester. Leicester attacked well for periods of that game, but they also ended up under the cosh as well, and they also lacked resilience. My point here is that there's lots of positives about a crowd that can get up and get behind a team. But if Leicester do something daft first 15 and Liverpool go 1-0 and maybe even find a way to go 2-0, there's every chance you've got a crowd that are making clear its disapproval. You know, this was an away end that was absolutely barracking them at Fulham in a massive way. And I just sort of wonder whether or not there's a lot of Leicester players a lot of Leicester supporters who've just had enough of these now. And we might get to see that on Monday night. The other side is that we might get the King Power absolutely roaring.
Yeah, I think we sometimes overstate like a Monday night kickoff because we automatically assume that the fans can be bang up for it and they're going to create an atmosphere. And that often does happen, right? But when something goes against a team and they're fighting for their lives and the team has been fighting for their lives the entire season and they're fed up with their players, that could quickly become very toxic, where if we score one goal and it becomes two goals very quickly, their ground could be an absolute mess for about 10, 15 minutes. It becomes difficult for the players. It becomes a difficult environment for the players to perform in. So I'm actually pretty confident that, as Dan says, if we do start well in the first half, if there's a Jota scrappy goal like he likes to do in these kind of games, or an early goal from someone, I'm confident we can actually take the game away from Leicester in the first half and go on to win fairly comfortably. I think their fans do get up for the games against us. I think there's a bit of needle between us and them. partly because they're massive weirdos, their fans, which is something we've had to live with for a couple of years.
They absolutely are, yes.
They're very weird. But yeah, I think this will be a game, like as Dan says, defined by the first half. And I think one thing we've done well in recent weeks is start well. Even last week against Brentford, I think we don't get the goal we want in that spell, but we start quite well, I think, and are able to, especially the first 10 minutes, I think we're able to really pen them in for a bit. So that's been key, and I think the shapes helped us do that. And I hope that, you know, moving forward, we can, in the last few games, we can, you know, start these games really, really fast and be intense, because I think that's something the manager wants. I wonder what Leicester are going to do around Trent, because I think it's difficult to have a Trent plan because he kind of floats about the pitch. But I wonder if there's going to be a team for, like, you know, 20, 30-minute spell that can just stick a man on Trent and try and limit him, because I think he's such a unique player in the Premier League. I think we often compare him to Kevin De Bruyne, but I actually think he's a bit more comfortable than De Bruyne in those deeper spaces. And I wonder if a team is going to try and try and stop him for a bit, because he really does make us tick. And the way he floats about, the passes he plays, he's always playing vertically as well, trying to fizz it through the lines. I wonder if Leicester, given the time they've had between the fixtures gone and the Monday game, I wonder if they're going to be a team going to try and do something with Trent over the game on Monday. But that's my kind of one question mark, really.
It's an interesting question mark, Sean. I think the main thing around that is whether or not they feel as though they've got the footballer to do it first and foremost. But also, I think the next thing on that is whether or not Liverpool then just find another way. You know, for me, we've talked all season about Liverpool allowing the opposition encouragement, and Liverpool allowing Leicester to even feel like they get a small tactical victory, which they may try to do on something like Trent Alexander-Arnold. It's important that nothing encourages them on Monday, on or off the pitch. You know, they've got threats. We've got to keep them out of it as well. And I think we'll see a lot in it with reference to whether or not they try to shackle Trent or don't, or where the game is. The positioning of Robertson, I think, will be a marker point.
Yes. So, yeah, a couple of things. I mean, Leicester have a number of options in terms of what to try and do. You know, you look at what teams have had to do against City. City haven't been able to just stick with the same sort of system as what Liverpool do. City do it a slightly different way, and Liverpool do it a slightly different way with different personnel. But City have had to do quite a bit of 4-2-4 in at times this year. And as an aside, I think that might be something you see this Liverpool team doing more and more of. In terms of Leicester, you know, if Liverpool don't start fast, that might be something Liverpool need to have a look at as well. It's an interesting one for Leicester, because when you're coming up against the kind of setup Liverpool have got, what some teams might do, Tottenham have done this quite successfully against teams in the past doing this, is they just gamble 5-4, 5-forward in like the build-up phase. They'd almost be like a 5-2-3. They go, okay, well, we'll throw 3 forwards onto Konate, Van Dijk, Robertson, try and steal it there, and we'll put 2 onto Trent and Fabinho. And if we steal it there, we're in. And for a team that can't, you wouldn't expect to be able to break Liverpool down in open play. And if they can, it's not going to be too regular. The carrot dangling there potentially early to do that, and then go, if that doesn't work, we've then got to try and hold Liverpool up and get 11 men behind the ball, become difficult to break down. I think if there is a way home for Leicester, that might be it. And I think with Liverpool, and just generally, something very underestimated in these games is territory. I think too often Liverpool come into these games, and Guardiola used to do this, let's keep possession to keep the crowd quiet. Well, you try and keep possession in your own penalty area, Anfield, under the lights, you ain't keeping the crowd quiet. That's red rag to a bull, because there's an almighty carrot dangling if we can steal that there. And when you've got players just trying to play their way in, especially on an away ground when they've only had a warm-up to get used to it, I'm not that bothered about Liverpool having a rapid start. I'm bothered about Liverpool having territory. I want the first 10 minutes of this game in Leicester's half.
Yes.
And I don't care if that means Liverpool are almost Brentford for the first couple of minutes and we're hitting Diags out of play into the corner and penning them in. I would like to see Salah and Diaz having plenty to get after in the wide areas. I don't want Liverpool to have any risk of giving away a gift or giving Leicester any encouragement. If they do go to press, Liverpool don't know if they will or they won't. I would be tempted in the build-up phase to move Trent wider as a surprise element. I think against weaker opposition, you could well do that. And one of my mum's phrases would be to skew if their plans. And if they have got a plan to maybe put a man-to-man marker on, then having Trent be much wider gives them an immediate problem and decision to make. I think the other thing, as you referenced there with Robertson, I think it's very important with the system that Robertson and Fabinho have really good distribution. One of the first Liverpool teams that like I watched regularly was when John Barnes had gone into central midfield. And the problem there was teams cottoned on. Very hard to stop Robbie Fowler. It's really hard to stop Steve McManaman. But if you stop John Barnes, you stop both of them, because both of them suddenly don't get much service because no one else has got the ability to put stuff into them in the right areas at the right way. And Liverpool can't allow themselves to be in a position where if Trent has a bad game or areas are locked down in and around him, that things become much more difficult. And I even think with Trent being there, I want to see our front five get more ball more regularly. I think that has been one of the slight weaknesses in this, that when the front five have had it, they've done really well with it. But I'd like us to have more ball and more possession with them higher up the park. And I think Robertson, Fabinho, if they can be right on it, then Curtis Jones, Diaz, potentially Cody Gakpo, whoever, are going to get a lot of ball, irrelevant really of what any Trent plan is or what you decide to do with Trent.
The question on that becomes, you know, Dan, they've obviously had a long break since the last game. It's now every few days, you know, they're not having to play midweek. So, you know, they've got a Monday-Saturday turnaround and then they've got a Saturday-Sunday turnaround. So on the selections, you know, he is pretty much able to pick who he wants, you would have thought. He didn't make any noises really on injuries today. You know, every now and again we get a bit of a surprise, but and it is a way off from Monday. But it's three to go, big breaks. The flip side of that, though, is he has had time to work with them and he could spring a surprise. I just sort of expect him, though, to whatever he currently feels is the 11 that he thinks is just going to win this game in front of him. And I think that for all three games, 9, maybe even 10 of the names will be exactly the same as he goes through. He may not have a nailed on first 11 right now, but I suspect he's got a first 9 and a first 10.
Yeah, I think you'd imagine, barring an injury, that back five of Konate, Van Dijk, Robertson, Trent and Fabinho working in that way would sort of be a case of you set that up and you go from there. I think, I've just had a look then, Nunes has 7 shots in the home game against these. Now, you can take that in many ways with Darwin. I didn't get to have a look quite where they were from and in what circumstance they come. But, you know, I think the big question around not just this one, but the rest of them will be, you know, when and how he uses Darwin Núñez, because you've got, you know, it seems like Jota's back and he's free, and Diogo Jota likes playing against Leicester. One would imagine, just on Mike's point before, they've got a bit of history. So, you know, yeah. I think that left side between him and Diaz will be a thing in itself. But I wonder whether the manager, having given Núñez those two games in the week at Anfield, and you know, having drawn his own conclusions from them, whatever they might be. What he's decided in terms of where he uses him. I've got a sneaky feeling he might get this one. He might get it through the middle, and it's not where I prefer him to be. You know, I do prefer him being that sort of outside in from the left type of forward. But I do think he might get this again, because, you know, I think there is benefit. You know, Sean's talking about territory. There is benefit to having a bit of a battering ram against these, especially with what they're like at centre-back, in full-back areas, and also I don't think the keeper's up to that much either. I've said that now, obviously. You know, that'll be the precursor for the game. But ultimately, you know, I think there will be a lot of territory for Liverpool, as Sean mentioned. I think there'll be a lot of possession. I think that there might not be the need, as there has been in recent games, for a Cody Gakpo / Firmino type of forward. The more we can get on it, that might be needed for the last half an hour rather than the first hour. So I just wonder what we do in that forward area. I think that'll define a lot.
All right, give us a prediction, Dan.
I think we'll win 3-1.
Win 3-1. Mike, what do you feel as though is... let's say the back five, the back six, including the goalkeeper, are as you'd expect. Do you think you'll start Jones?
I think he has to start Jones. Jones is we haven't got many options for that left-sided centre midfielder role, especially because that player has to often drift out wide. And Jones is the only person I feel comfortable with playing a lot of football inside of and outside on the left-hand side as well.
So he starts Jones. Do you think he'll start Henderson?
I think he will, given the rest. I think his go-to midfield with this shape is Jones, Henderson and Fabinho.
And what do you think his front three will be?
I think it will be Diaz, Gakpo and Salah. And that's what I want it to be as well. I think those three are the most comfortable I feel with in terms of, you know, ball retention and individual quality at the moment. Joss is the sort of player that can get you a goal, and I think him and Gakpo can kind of compete for a spot, but I really trust those three at the moment in terms of how they're playing.
And give us a prediction then.
Prediction 3-1 like Dan. I think they'll score, but I think we'll have too much for them.
Sean, I'm going to go with Mike's midfield and presume that you're in agreement. I didn't, you weren't pulling a face like you weren't. Who do you think he'll do up front? Salah and which two?
I think he'll go Salah, Gakpo, Jota, myself. But I would like to see Diaz, Nunes, Salah with Cody Gakpo in the Henderson role with Jones in there for games like this. I was interested in seeing how that would go against Brentford. And just because of the way the game went, we never got to see Gakpo have enough ball. I think he did a good role for the team, but we never got a chance to see him have enough ball. In terms of prediction, I think we'll be winning 2-1. And then in the last sort of 10, run riot. Almost like Leeds, but later in the game. I think we'll be leading narrowly and Leicester will have the kitchen sink. And I think with subs and some of the attacking, that Leicester are not going to be able to open this game up and not get battered, in my view, unless they're extremely lucky. So as long as Liverpool are leading, I think we'll win by, if not 3, 4, 5. The biggest problem is if we go 1-0 down at that place. I'd rather go to an away on the North Pole, having done Leicester away. It is the worst away, I suspect, in the world. So
doing it Monday, you know, Sean. I'm doing it Monday.
Yeah, I'm amazed we have travelling fans going to this fixture. Fair play to them. They're much better fans than I am. I think as long as Liverpool... I don't even mind if Liverpool get pegged back or something like that. As long as it doesn't go 1-0, I think we'll absolutely batter these.
I've worked out, by the way, that there's at least two sets of terrible lads getting relegated this season. You know, I'll leave that to you. Make that what you will.
Work that out any way you want to go. Thank you very much to Dan, to Sean, and to Mike, to John and John, and to Dan again, and me. I did that bit as well. That has been Tour Live this week. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's a long way off until Monday. There's a lot of life to live between now and then. Make sure you do that. See you later. Sports Social Podcast Network.